From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Now there are two, and they're both women, Chavez and Whitman, Bush nominees in a swirl of controversy around the hiring of undocumented immigrants. We'll speak with immigrant rights activists. Also, the Congressional Black Caucus walks out of the certification of the electoral vote. We'll speak with Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters. And more with the only reporter present at the 1975 Pine Ridge shootout that led to the quarter of a century incarceration of Native American leader Leonard Peltier. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Jerusalem. A lawyer has filed a petition calling on Israel's Supreme Court to stop the army from carrying out a policy of assassinating Palestinian activists. The lawyer, Nalia Atiya, said she was asking for the Supreme Court to issue an injunction until it rules on her petition. She said the killings were against Israeli law and contravened the Geneva Convention. Palestinians say that Israel has assassinated more than 20 activists in the last 3 months. Israel denies it has a policy of political assassination, but Israel's deputy defense minister told Reuters that security forces were authorized to, quote, hit precisely those top operatives of terrorist organizations who mastermind and organize attacks on Israel. In one of the biggest demonstrations in Jerusalem's history, more than 200,000 Israelis jammed the streets outside the ancient walls of the old city yesterday, protesting U.S. proposals to give partial control of a disputed holy site to the Palestinians. The protest came shortly after the Palestinian Authority rejected President Clinton's proposals as a basis for ending conflict with Israel. A Palestinian negotiator said Clinton had failed in his efforts to achieve a final peace because his aides were influenced by Israeli positions that had already been rejected by the Palestinians. And tonight, Oklahoma is scheduled to execute Eddie Treece. He will be the first of 8 executions in Oklahoma this month. We're joined by Opio Ture, an Oklahoma City Democratic representative who's introduced a bill that would set a 1-year moratorium on state executions. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. I know later today, Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, will be holding a news conference. Can you tell us about this spate of executions, 8 until February 1st?
Well, unfortunately, Oklahoma has one of the highest death row totals in the country. Last year, we were second only to Texas in actually executing people. We're far out of whack in terms of our proportion. Proportion of our population, and it's just something that we have to deal with. We have a growing movement here in Oklahoma for a moratorium on the death penalty. Unfortunately, the majority of opinion here supports death penalty, but we believe here at the legislature that we can convince legislators because of support by the citizens to stop executions for at least a year so that we can study and correct the defects in the processes.
I understand a number of Oklahoma ministers are considering acts of civil disobedience in support of your bill, for a 1-year moratorium.
Last week we had a gigantic march and rally in support of halting the executions. We have one, as you mentioned, scheduled this evening. My moratorium bill, unfortunately, would not stop those that are scheduled, the executions that are scheduled this month, because our legislature doesn't convene until February the 5th. So the clergy and other citizens of conscience are doing everything they can to show their support for a moratorium now by executive action, by executive order, by our governor. And the clergy and others are discussing acts of courage. I've personally begun a fast, and others are fasting and praying now that the government will issue a moratorium, and we're praying for the victims of homicide and the victims of the families of the victims and the families of those who are on death row and those who are on death row themselves.
Opio Ture, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Oklahoma State Representative sponsoring a bill calling for a one-year moratorium on state executions. And in other news, in one of the biggest demonstrations, as I said earlier, 200,000 Israelis took to the streets yesterday protesting President Clinton's what he calls peace initiative. Back here at home, corporations with interests before the federal government are spending tens of thousands of dollars to help Washington-based state social groups celebrate George W. Bush's inauguration. At the Illinois State Society's reception, United Airline, based in Elk Grove Village, Illinois, is sponsoring a Hall of Illinois Heroes exhibit that honors prominent Illinoisans. Verizon Communications is contributing to a black tie bash thrown by the Texas Society that will feature a 2,500-pound Brahmin bull, 7,000 pounds of beef brisket, and 1,200 pounds of peach cobbler. Lockheed Martin, one of the world's largest weapons manufacturers, is helping to cover the cost of the California Society's inaugural luncheon. These galas are in addition to the official ball sponsored by the Presidential Inaugural Committee. President-elect Bush takes the oath of office on January 20th. The state societies exist so expatriates can get a taste of the places they left behind when they moved to the nation's capital. Members include federal lawmakers who will be voting on the issues affecting the society's sponsors. Charles Lewis, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, says they're trying to get close to people in power. They can do it by writing a check. They know it, and everyone in Washington knows it. Ford Motor Company and Bridgestone Firestone, Inc. have settled a lawsuit with a Texas woman left paralyzed after a tire-related crash in an Explorer last year, averting a courtroom drama that would have focused new attention on one of the nation's most serious highway safety investigations. The exact amount of the settlement has not been disclosed, but sources close to the case say Ford and Firestone agreed to pay Donna Bailey, who's 44 years old, a total of between $20 and $35 million.
Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God.
Moby singing Natural Blues here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Moby's real name is Richard Melville Hall, descendant of Herman Melville, author of Moby Dick. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we take on the issue of the day. Linda Chavez, Bush's nominee for the Department of Labor, and Christine Todd Whitman, slated to head the Environmental Protection Agency, are both being caught up in a swirl of controversy around the issue of using undocumented immigrants as domestic laborers. The New Jersey governor had acknowledged in 1993 that she hired a Portuguese couple who was in the country illegally and at the time failed to pay the requisite Social Security taxes. In Linda Chavez's case, the nominee is falling afoul of the very regulation she'll be called on to enforce if she's confirmed for the top labor post. Chavez either harbored or hired an undocumented Guatemalan immigrant for 2 years. At least that's the way the law puts it, harboring an undocumented immigrant. According to Chavez, she housed Marta Mercado as an act of charity, and the more than $1,000 a year she gave the immigrant was not compensation for household chores, but simply a handout. Nonetheless, the Department of Labor says that domestic workers, like housekeepers, cooks, and babysitters, are covered by federal wage laws if they earn at least $1,000 a year or work more than 8 hours a week. Mercado was living with Chavez when President Clinton's nominees for attorney general were derailed for employing undocumented immigrants. You may remember Kimba Wood and Zoe Baird. At the time, Chavez criticized the nominations. Issues of wages or taxes aside, it is illegal to, quote, harbor an undocumented immigrant. Although Chavez says she was unaware of Mercado's legal status, Mercado says she told Chavez she was illegally in the United States while living with the nominee. Almost lost in the debate over Chavez's relationship with Marta Mercado are Chavez's qualifications for labor secretary, as well as the plight of the country's undocumented workers forced to work for substandard wages and denied fundamental rights. Today, we're going to take a look at these issues. We're joined by Ai-Jen Poo, who is an organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence in New York, and Kathy Toktokian, who is director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Let's begin with Kathy Toktokian on the telephone. What is your reaction to the controversy? First, Linda Chavez, and now Christine Todd Whitman.
Well, I'll be glad to see the nomination of Linda Chavez derailed, if in fact that is the case. She's well known for being anti-worker, an anti-immigrant, and it would be a travesty to have the position of labor secretary. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing again where immigration is still a lightning rod, where what's being appealed to, I think, is still some public hostility towards undocumented immigrants, the so-called illegal aliens, which may be the focal point for her being derailed in this position. And again, yes, it did happen in 1993 with both Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood. And at the time, attention was also called to Christine Todd Whitman. And I think, you know, during those times, it was interesting because everyone noticed that for those two people in those positions, two women, their background as people in position to hire household workers or to have household workers was being examined, kind of a double standard, where that same standard wasn't being applied to male nominees or candidates for public office. In this case, I think those of us in the immigrant rights movement would all be glad to see Linda Chavez go down the drain on this position. She has a whole history of being anti-immigrant. She was an advisor to Ron Unz, the author of Proposition 227, the Anti-Bilingual Education Initiative. She was head of U.S. English for years, which was the main organization lobbying for English-only policies across the country. And she resigned only when it became publicly known that one of the founders of the organization had written a memo in 1986 in which he proposed very racist rationales for initiating anti-immigrant strategies.
Jack Martin is Special Projects Coordinator with the Federation for American Immigration Reform, well known for their stance against immigrants coming into this country. Your response to the latest issue of Marta Mercado living with Linda Chavez and working for her? Jack Martin.
Time that her problem is because of the fact that she has taken in immigrants into her house as sort of family members, but nevertheless, we have a tremendous problem with illegal immigration in this country, and in the past 8 years, the administration has tended to look aside rather than really dealing with it except for strengthening border control. And what we really need is we need an administration that's going to seriously deal with the problem, and I think that the Bush team really needs to start out the administration by showing that they are going to be serious about this, and that means not condoning what appears to be a felony of harboring an illegal alien, which is what the circumstances that have come out seem to indicate.
Ai-Jen Poo in the studio with us, Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. Your response?
Immigration, in my opinion, is not the problem here. The focus of the situation should not be the immigration status of the worker. The real issue here is the fact that the domestic worker Chavez hired was exploited. She was clearly underpaid for her work. And this is an industry where there are no standards, no contracts, and abuse like this is really common. What Chavez is doing is giving all those abusive employers the opportunity to say that they are being charitable. We know that many public officials on all levels hire domestic workers, and we regularly get cases of live-in and live-out domestic workers from poor nations who are taken advantage of. And this is why we're currently fighting to set some standards in the domestic industry. We recently heard of a case of a domestic worker who did childcare and housekeeping for an employer around the clock, 7 days a week, to support her family abroad, and was paid about $200 per month for this work, not very different amount from what Chavez paid her domestic worker. This money she never even saw because it was directly deposited into an account abroad. And what we need to do is put an end to this kind of flagrant abuse of workers in this industry, and set some standards and take away the opportunity for abusive employers like this diplomat, like this employer, and like Chavez, and to say that this is actually about charity.
The issue, particularly in Washington, has embroiled a number of women nominees over the years. You can't help but notice Zoe Baird, Kimba Wood. I think the Supreme Court nominee, I'm not sure if it was Stephen Breyer, who an issue was raised in his family, but somehow that was shrugged off as not being in his sphere. Let me ask Kathy Takhtakian about this point. On the one hand, you may have the situation of exploitation. On the other hand, we're talking about why women are pinned with this, of course, a certain class of women.
Well, and I think certainly, you know, it's an indication of the state of the economy and some of the class position that allows right now a number of households to be able to, hire household help. We're looking at situations in which, across the board, women are working in greater and greater proportions, and yet we don't have really family-oriented policies that at the same time provide adequately for child care, and certainly for poor, low-income working women, much less for people in Linda Chavez's position or Zoe Baird, who was making $500,000 as an executive at Aetna and who was able to return to that position after that fiasco in 1993, and her household worker pretty much disappeared into the pool of domestic workers that Ai-Jen Poo described. So we're dealing with, bigger and more complex problems. The workers who are feeling those needs for nannies, for, as child care workers, as household workers, very often are immigrant women. And today we have a situation in which more than half of the immigrants to the United States, regardless of status, are women. And they face, often multiple levels of difficulty as women, as immigrants, as women of color. And often household work as child care is just about the only work that they can find. So it is bad that we don't have policies that protect them, or at a broader level, that have really established standards that provide adequate, well-paid child care for all the children in this country.
Jack Martin of FAIR, the Federation of American Immigration Reform, how would you like to see U.S. laws changed?
Well, I think that the other speakers have described a situation that is a real problem, but I think that there has been a tendency to overlook the fact that much of the exploitation is largely a factor of illegal immigration. The people who are willing to work at below minimum wage levels and in abusive conditions are doing so because of the fact that they're in the country illegally. I think that the corrective measures are necessary with regard to providing the infrastructure that allows women to work and to fully develop their potential in the job force. But that is being deferred by having a ready supply of illegal aliens in the country who are willing to work in for low wage conditions, and in effect put off the need to address those reforms. And I think the best way that we can force ourselves into adopting the measures that are necessary to take care of that situation is to reduce the supply of the illegal aliens willing to take those jobs.
Kathy Taktakian, when we talk about Linda Chavez, she ultimately was forced to resign from a board of an English-only group around a memo that was released. Can you talk about this?
Well, in 1986, John Tanton, who was a founder of FAIR and also a founder of U.S. English, and that was the board which Linda Chavez chaired, issued a memo, which was part of a whole discussion of strategy within FAIR over the coming years on how to address the immigration problem, and especially how to call attention to the problem of illegal immigration. And in that memo, he raised just a number of clearly racist statements that were particularly calling attention to the growing majority of non-white people in the United States due to immigration, and questioned whether the white population was going to sit still and allow this to happen. And it's interesting because one of the things that was mentioned in that memo was the need to go to the environmental movement and win support from the environmental movement against immigration on the basis of for environmental reasons, that immigrants would increase the population, that would be a leading factor in environmental degradation, and therefore, environmentalists should also jump on board against immigration. That is, in fact, something that has happened over the years, where population control advocates have gone to the environmental movement, to organizations like the Sierra Club, to get them on board with their anti-immigrant agenda. So this was not kind of a minor memo. It really outlined strategies that, in fact, we have seen come about through organizations like FAIR. And when this memo finally became public, Linda Chavez and then Walter Cronkite, who was also on the board, both resigned, and they repudiated it. However, I think most people just thought it was totally unbelievable that they had been unaware of kind of the racist undertones or discussions that would have taken place in U.S. English with John Tanton present, and then were skeptical when they repudiated it only when it became public.
Jack Martin, your response.
Well, referring to the specific incident, all I would say is that version which you just heard of the event was the version that was put out by Linda Chavez, and as I understand it, there were some other issues at play leading to her desire to separate herself from the organization. But nevertheless, I think that what is probably more important is focusing on what it was that the Tanton was talking about, which was the rapid population increase in the United States, which is not only true, but it is even greater than it was suspected at that time, as the most recent census data shows. And we have real problems in this country, particularly in California, for example, where they're having their brownouts and tremendous traffic jams.
Kathy Tuck-Tuckin, is that because of immigrants?
Well, no, and this has certainly been a controversy that has been swirling for years, but to say that population growth alone or, you know, is even a key factor in environmental degradation, you know, is really scandalous. We're a country that, you know, with 5% of the world's population is using 30% of its resources worldwide. We have companies that are running rampant, utilizing and degrading the environment and using natural resources. We have overdevelopment, not because of population growth, but that which is expansion that's profit-driven.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but Ajahn Poo, one last word.
We need standards for the domestic work industry to protect the rights of domestic workers. We need better laws to protect the rights of all workers, and we need a legalization for undocumented workers.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ajahn Poo is an organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence in New York, Kathy Tuck-Tuckin, Director, National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Jack Martin of FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform, and retired Foreign Service Officer in the State Department. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll break for a minute, then come back with Congressmember Maxine Waters. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Congress met in joint session over the weekend to certify the Electoral College vote that made George W. Bush the official president of the United States. But while congressional certification is usually routine and uneventful this year, Black caucus members walked out of the chamber in protest after attempting to block the counting of Florida's 25 contested electoral votes. The African-American lawmakers defiantly declared at a subsequent news conference that they did not consider Bush the legitimate president. We're joined right now by Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters to talk about why she walked out and what are the upcoming battles she sees in Congress under a new Bush administration. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Waters.
And thank you for your patience. I should have been on earlier.
Oh, thanks so much for being with us. What happened Saturday?
Well, we chose to challenge the acceptance of the electoral votes from Florida because of all of the allegations of fraud and what appears to be disenfranchisement that took place in Florida. Usually, these are ceremonial sessions, business as usual. And I feel that the nation was traumatized by the events in Florida. And I did not feel that it sent the correct message, number one, for members not to be there, not to raise questions, and not try and defy the acceptance of those electoral votes, even if you were out of compliance with the rules. We didn't have a member of the Senate who signed on to the objections. It must be in writing, must be signed by a member of the House and the Senate. And so we took the opportunity to go to the floor and try and voice our objections and let the world know that we were not satisfied, we were not happy, and this struggle shall continue. A lot of work, a lot of sacrifices have been made for voting rights, and we feel that there were violations of the Voting Rights Act. There must be election reform, and this session of Congress is going to have any number of efforts to try and deal with some of the problems as they were illuminated in Florida.
So you have this unusual situation where one person after another gets up,
yes.
Like Alcee Hastings of Florida, the first to object, talking about the overwhelming evidence of official misconduct.
Yes.
And he is gaveled down by Vice President Gore.
Yeah. Isn't that ironic? Gore is, as the Vice President of the United States, presided over the joint session, and he cited the rules to us over and over again. He would ask us if we had a member of the United States Senate who had signed. We would say no. Most of the members said, I have signed. My constituents wish me to do this. And we got a word or two in about our feelings about those electoral votes and the fact that we did not feel that they represented the popular vote. And we drew the attention and challenged the institution in ways that it's just not done. And I think that we have set the tone for the struggle and the fight that we're going to engage in order to correct some of these ills in the system.
Now, why couldn't you get a senator to support what you're doing? I mean, we know there are no black senators, but the person doesn't just have to be black to object to what has happened.
No. Let me just say this. I think we didn't get one because, you know, once you get in this Congress, you are kind of whipped into line on tradition. Tradition is such that you don't challenge these electoral votes once they get to the Congress. And for members to step outside of that is too much for most of them. They just don't have the courage to do this. We are black elected officials, and we led this effort, but we would have taken anybody who wished to join with us. But it's typical of the struggle of this kind. Usually, these kinds of struggles are seen to be cutting edge, outside the box, and we have to do it when others won't do it. And sometimes, you know, others will catch up to us in our struggles for civil rights and for justice, but it's not easy to get people to be the first or to be on the front end. We have to do the work and bring people along, and it's never been done before, and nobody was willing to do it.
Congressmember Waters, Florida's established a commission to look into voting irregularities. Is that enough?
No. Florida should do that. Every state should review its voting systems. The Congress of the United States must be involved, and we can be involved in a number of ways. We need to look at whether or not we can set standards for federal elections and our participation in the ballot and what we would require in order for them to carry our presidential candidates on the ballot and our United States senators and our members of Congress on the ballot. I think we can do that. And we need to look at whether or not there needs to be an appropriation to help support entities that need to get up to speed, up to date with new technology and get rid of these old voting machines that break down and don't count properly. And I think that we need to have a federal review and federal legislation and state-by-state review, and states need to bring their systems up to date. So a lot of work has to be done over the next couple of years.
When we see a headline in the New York Times like Bush reaffirms his confidence in labor choice, that's Linda Chavez, you realize this is probably the beginning of the end for her. This and the controversy around whether she had an illegal immigrant working in her house and not compensating her properly, et cetera, though that's not going to be the part that's emphasized. Republicans say the silver lining of this is that if she's taken out, there'll be less focus on Ashcroft to be the attorney general. What is your take on Ashcroft?
Well,
how hard are you going to...
Things. We should not be put in an either-or situation. I'm embarrassed for Linda Chavez and the story that she's telling. I mean, it's like... it's so unbelievable. It's like the joke. Yeah, you believe that, and let me sell you a bridge. I mean, it just doesn't ring true at all. And again, it is so transparent that I am embarrassed for her. And I think that in addition to this problem, there are a lot of other reasons why we should be opposing her because of who she is, her standards, what she has described as wanting this to be English-only country, her strident remarks against organized labor and minorities. I mean, there's just, I mean, we have to oppose her. But in addition to that, we have to oppose Ashcroft, too. And we shouldn't be in the position, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to get organized into a position where if we take Linda out, that Ashcroft is going to be confirmed for sure.
What are your major objections to Ashcroft, the former Missouri senator?
Well, I was stunned by the way in which he undermined Ronnie White. It was not just a matter of being opposed. He lied on him. He tried to make him soft on crime. He went out and organized the police community to oppose him. He distorted his record, claimed that he did not support death penalty, and while I don't either, the fact of the matter is the man had supported it 71%. In his judgeship. And so I have more information that's coming about some of what has taken place back there in the legislature years past. But also, it's clear to me that in addition to his feelings and the way that he's opposed so many minority candidates, it's really about freedom of choice. And that he hates Ronnie White because of something that happened back in Missouri. And so I think all of it has to come out. We're going to have to unfold who this man really is. They keep going around talking about he's moral, he's a Christian, he's in support of civil rights. Well, the record is going to speak for itself, and we're going to be right there to help expose him.
Speaking back about Linda Chavez and the story she's telling, there's an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal today that says that the Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into a conversation Labor Secretary-designate Linda Chavez had last month with a former neighbor about an illegal alien who lived with Chavez for a time in the early 90s. The neighbor, Margaret Zwissler, employed the woman for household tasks during the same period between 91 and 93. She lived in Chavez's home, where the Guatemalan woman performed chores and was given what Bush transition officials have termed spending money. There's some concern among investigators that the conversation may have been an attempt by Chavez to influence how Zwissler would respond to questions by FBI background investigators who typically interview top nominees' neighbors and former neighbors. Chavez has insisted she took in and helped financially support the woman as an act of charity but didn't employ her. Marta Mercado and the individual who introduced the two women offered similar accounts yesterday. So this is an interesting added issue, is what she was telling her neighbor possibly to say or to influence what she might say to FBI investigators.
Well, I certainly hope it all comes out. It just seems to me that, you know, this business about she was just helping the woman out, the woman needs to be asked, and what did she do? What was her chores? You know, what did she do in the house? Did she clean? Did she wash? Did she do the kinds of things that a day laborer would do in a home? And what's even more interesting, based on the story that you're telling me now, is not only did she appear, in my estimation, to have worked and performed duties for Linda Chavez, it sounded as if she was leased out to the neighbor to do the same kind of chores for pay. And if Linda Chavez is trying to tell us that she was just helping her out and that she was not employed by her, was she employed by her neighbor? Did her neighbor pay her? Did she know about it? Did she introduce her to the neighbor? I mean, really, I think that before she further embarrasses herself, she needs to get out of this because I think it's going to get ugly.
You know, it's interesting. It's usually Republicans who are opposed to what we've come to call in this country illegal immigrants, undocumented workers. This cuts around a lot of lines, too, though, because it has to do with just compensation for domestic workers. But what's your response to that?
Well, of course, Linda Chavez is one of those Republicans who's been, in my estimation, publicly harsh on immigration. Not only has she dishonored her own culture by saying that this should be English-only country, she has shown no real mercy or no real concern about trying to help us fix the immigration laws to help undocumented workers become legal, and at the same time, to use them in the way that she appears to have used them is just plain hypocrisy. And again, I think it's quite transparent, and I don't care what she says. I don't believe it, and I don't think most people will believe it. And I think if the FBI and others do it right and the vetting is done properly, it will all come out.
Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters, thank you for taking the time to be with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll specifically take a quick look at the labor record of Linda Chavez. The labor secretary designate is supported by the National Association of Manufacturers, but not by the AFL-CIO. And then part two of our conversation with Kevin McKiernan, the only reporter to have covered the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation shootout in 1975. He wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times on Sunday calling on President Clinton to commute the sentence of Native American leader Leonard Peltier. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Subsumed in the debate over her relationship with an undocumented immigrant is Linda Chavez's record on worker issues and her qualifications to head the Department of Labor. She is well known for opposing minimum wage increases, affirmative action, and on the Lehrer NewsHour last night won the enthusiastic support of the head of the National Association of Manufacturers. According to a GAO report, when Linda Chavez was head of the Civil Rights Commission under Reagan, quote, all 31 of her appointments contained indications of irregularities. The AFL-CIO charged that Chavez had turned the commission into a political patronage operation. We're joined now by Lacio Medina, who is Executive Vice President for Western Region of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, speaking to us from Los Angeles. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Your response to the Linda Chavez nomination?
Well, I think President Bush is confused, President-elect Bush. Instead of appointing someone who's supposed to look out for the welfare of working men and women, he basically appointed a person who is more qualified to be in charge of the Department of Commerce. Here we have a woman who opposes minimum wage. She opposes affirmative action. She thinks women who file complaints of sexual discrimination are crybabies. She thinks that it's bad policy to provide for facilities for disabled people. She thinks that affirmative action is special treatment, and that she's totally opposed to that. And I think that these are all laws that she would have to enforce as the head of the Department of Labor. And how can she do that when she is totally opposed to these policies? And I think this is a wrong appointment. It's wrong for working people, and I think it's wrong for America.
How are you organizing around it now?
Well, we're going to be obviously organizing throughout the country to have our members and working people in general communicate with their senators who will be charged with passing on this nomination. And we're going to urge them that this is that they ought to reject the nomination. And we hope that they listen to working people and reject it.
Eliseo Medina, what is your response to the whole issue of the use of undocumented workers, the whole issue that has come up around Marta Mercado?
I'm an immigrant myself, and I think that they exemplify the hypocrisy of an immigration policy of this country that says that it's okay for immigrants to come and work in this country, to take care of our children, to cook our food, to work in the fields, to work in a manufacturing party. It's just not okay to give them the same rights that we would have in this country. And here we have a situation where Linda Chavez Thompson was hiring an undocumented worker, and I've heard this story hundreds
Linda Chavez Thompson?
I'm sorry, Linda Chavez.
I know Linda Chavez Thompson, and Linda Chavez is no Linda Chavez Thompson.
Absolutely. You're absolutely
one
right.
of the officials of the AFL-CIO.
That's right. No, Linda Chavez has hired an undocumented worker, was not paying Social Security, was not paying taxes. And this is a story that we've heard over and over again from other employers. And they all say when they're caught, gee, I didn't know. And I was just being nice. Well, give me a break.
Eliseo Medina, you're Executive Vice President for the Western Region of SEIU, of the Service Employees International Union. As you said, you're an immigrant yourself.
Yes.
What is your take on the mainstream media touting the diversity of the Bush cabinet?
Well, this is not about color or ethnic origin. This is about what America is going to be like. And it's not enough to get somebody whose last name is Chavez or Martinez. It's about are people going to have access to education for their kids? Are they going to have access to health insurance? Are they going to make a living wage? Are their rights going to be protected? And unfortunately, when I look at this cabinet that's being assembled by President-elect Bush, what we see is our worst fears being confirmed. That is, this is a cabinet that is not going to be for all Americans, that is not going to represent all of us. It's going to represent a point of view of the business elite. It's going to represent the point of view of the conservative establishment of the U.S., and that's not the majority of us. And so I think that it's not enough to for a few people with ethnic surnames to get good-paying jobs in Washington. What we need is somebody who will represent all of us, and I think that's absent in this incoming administration.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Eliseo Medina, Executive Vice President for Western Region, the Service Employees International Union, speaking to us from Los Angeles. As we move now to the last segment of our program, part two of our conversation with reporter Kevin McKiernan. He was the only journalist present during the 1975 shootings at the Pine Ridge Reservation that resulted in the deaths of two FBI agents and one Native American. In Sunday's Los Angeles Times, McKiernan calls on President Clinton to commute the life sentence of Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Kevin McKiernan, thanks for joining us again.
Good morning.
Well, you say in your piece, the government has never produced an eyewitness in the deaths of the agents, and prosecutors admit they still don't know who actually killed Kohler and Williams. And you describe a pervasive climate of fear on the reservation. On that first point, since President Clinton now has 11 days to make a difference, to make a decision on granting Leonard Peltier executive clemency, Can you elaborate on that issue of prosecutors saying they still don't know who actually killed Kohler and Williams, and yet Peltier has been in prison now at Leavenworth for a quarter of a century?
There have been a number of appeals over the years to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis. And I recall in 1985 that one of the prosecutors, Lynn Crooks, told the court at that time with some exasperation that the government could not prove who killed the agents. The government had a theory who killed the agents, but admitted at that time that it could not prove who had done it. I think the problem today is that there are so many questions that linger from those days. The chief of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals at that time said that it was the hardest case that he had faced in 22 years on the bench. There were no eyewitnesses. The co-defendants of Peltier were acquitted in a separate trial on the grounds of self-defense, despite the fact that testimony indicated they had fired in the direction of the agents that day. There was also conflicting circumstantial evidence, and as far as the extradition affidavits, the affidavits that were used to get Peltier back from Canada, the court described them. They were false. They purported to be the affidavits of an eyewitness, and later she recanted her testimony. And the court characterized the government's use of those affidavits as a clear abuse of investigatory process by the FBI. In addition to that, there was the matter of the withheld evidence, the ballistics report that apparently was exculpatory on the rifle attributed to Peltier. That was withheld by the government. And the chief judge said, while upholding the conviction, he said that that cast a strong doubt on the government's case. So I think these are some of the matters that still are in the air from that period of time.
We're talking to Kevin McKiernan, who is a reporter for NPR at the time of the shootout, and also later became a stringer for the New York Times. You mentioned at the hearing before the House Human Rights Caucus last May that the FBI was using the reservation as a SWAT training ground. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, remember that the occupation of Wounded Knee, which exploded in 1973, this was 2 years before the shootings that you're talking about, which took place in 1975. At that time, the FBI had no SWAT team. The United States Marshals Service had developed a SWAT team in Puerto Rico a couple of years earlier, and that had a SWAT team, the SOG, the Special Operations Group. But the FBI did not have its own SWAT team, and there was a lot of interagency jealousy at the time. And in fact, there were a lot of disputes at the time between the FBI and the Marshals at Wounded Knee. In the years that followed, in the years that led up to the shootings in 1975, there was a tremendous amount of training. Pine Ridge was used as a training ground for the new FBI SWAT team. In fact, as I recall from one filmed interview I did at the time, the resident agent in Rapid City told me on camera that some 2,600 FBI agents had been rotated through the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in that three-year period from 1973 to 1976. So these shootings take place at that time and within that atmosphere.
We're talking again to Kevin McKiernan, reporter on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The FBI makes a lot out of the FBI jacket that Joe Stuntz was wearing, the Native American who was killed, alleging he must have gone to the agents' cars to have gotten the jacket. Is it possible that Stuntz was shot in the back and that the jacket was put on him posthumously to cover that fact?
Well, anything's possible. I just know what I saw that day. I didn't see the bodies of the dead agents. I did photograph Joe Stuntz's body. He was lying on his back. He was wearing the jacket. He might have put it on himself. It might have been put on him. I have no idea.
You took the first picture of him?
Yes, I did. And there was a BIA policeman standing over him, and soon after that, I was hustled out of the area and left.
What about President Clinton in considering executive clemency for Leonard Peltier in these last 11 days before he leaves office? met with the former governor of South Dakota, Bill Janklow. What about Bill Janklow's role? When he left, Clinton said he found him convincing. I'm not sure which side that means, but of course we know that Janklow is very much for Peltier not getting executive clemency. But he's also well known for some comments like the only way to deal with an AIM member, that's the American Indian Movement member, is putting a gun to his head and pulling the trigger.
Well, Bill Janklow was a very controversial, very partisan figure. He began as a lawyer in the Legal Services Corporation, actually representing American Indians on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in the 60s. In the 1970s, he rose to prominence during the AIM conflict and during the conflict with the Goons in South Dakota. Those are the supporters of then-tribal chairman Richard Wilson. Bill Janklow was very much of a partisan. His campaign initially for attorney general was a campaign which was very anti-American Indian movement, and some say very anti-Indian. And to this day, he's perceived in that role, and I think it's given that he went to Washington and argued against the possible clemency of Leonard Peltier.
And yet President Clinton hasn't, at least that we know of, met with the supporters of Leonard Peltier, those calling for executive clemency.
That's right.
Did you follow the FBI's rally, first ever rally that the FBI held in the last few weeks against clemency?
Well, I followed it in the press, and I know that there were some 300 agents at the White House with placards, and that 9,000 or 10,000 signatures of law enforcement members were delivered to the White House in opposition to the possible clemency.
Of course, it got a lot more attention in the mainstream press than the thousands who had marched just 5 days before in New York City for executive clemency. But as you describe what was happening on the reservation, people just talk about what happened on June 26, 1975, the shootout, but the reign of terror of the years before. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that the shootout at Oglala is a tragedy not only for the three men who died there, the two agents and the one AIM member, and for their friends and families, of course, but I think it's part of a greater tragedy, and I think it's the tragedy of U.S. relations with American Indians as a whole. From that time period, there was a climate of fear. It's one of the more dangerous places that I've worked as a reporter. I've had, guns placed in my face. I remember a time trying to film a goon squad, a vigilante roadblock. I remember another time when I was slammed up against a wall by goons. They all perceived the press as being AIM sympathizers, and they had very little time for us.
Again, goons, guardians of the Oglala Nation, the henchmen of Dick Wilson at the time.
So it was a dangerous time. I used to breathe a sigh of relief when I drove out of the state of South Dakota in those days. It felt a little bit like Checkpoint Charlie. Many people have seen the film Mississippi Burning, but I think that what happened in South Dakota during those days makes that pale by comparison. It was a dangerous place. I had the brakes cut on my car, and I think on one occasion a high-powered rifle blew a hole in another automobile in which I was riding. I mean, all of us were afraid, but I think that the real people who suffered during those days were the people who were victims of the firebombings and the drive-by shootings. I think the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation pioneered this awful concept of drive-by shootings that came into prominence in L.A. and other cities in the 1990s. That was going on all the time during that period.
You compared in your piece in the Times, the Los Angeles Times, your experience there with El Salvador in the Middle East. You talk about the FBI deploying Huey 1 or Huey Cobra attack helicopter on the reservation.
Well, I didn't see any attack helicopter on the reservation. There were helicopters, though, that were used to ferry federal agents from here and there, but no Cobra helicopters to my memory. But the senator, the U.S. senator at the time from South Dakota, complained about the inactivity of the FBI in looking into the dozens of murders that took place, and many of which are still unsolved to this day. And that was Senator James Aberesk, the U.S. senator from South Dakota, and he said that the lawless atmosphere on the reservation at the time approached total anarchy. So this is a time period from which I don't think anyone's hands are clean. There were a lot of bad activities, and there was a lot of inactivity when there might have been activity.
Kevin McCarron, I want to thank you for being with us. Piece in the Times this weekend calling for President Clinton to commute the sentence of Leonard Peltier. And you can call Leonard. You can call the White House at 202-456-1111. That does it for Democracy Now!, produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Salone, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.